This is a production of Cornell University.
And it is 4:30 on the October 8th at 401 Physical Sciences, and I call this meeting of the University Assembly to order. For those of you who I have not met, I don't see anybody, but just for the record, I'm Jim Blair, this year's Chair of the University Assembly. Welcome. Today, our meeting focus is on the Faculty Senate's recommendations regarding the Hope Plaza incident of 19 November 2012. Some of those recommendations request action by the University Assembly. So we have invited Professor Rick Elmendinger, who was one of three authors of an ad hoc committee who investigated the incident and reported to the Faculty Senate on their findings and recommendations. And we have also invited Professor David Pelletier to present the Faculty Senate's actual response on behalf of the UFC. The UFC is what I would call the executive, is this the right term, executive governing body of the Faculty Senate. And they have put out the Faculty Senate's official response to the Hope Plaza incident. I understand that Professor Bill Fry may join us later. He was also on the ad hoc committee, and he may join Rick later in the meeting and may be available to answer some questions later on. With that, are there any late additions to the agenda? Hearing none, we move to approval of the minutes of September 10th, 2013. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Do I have a second? A second from Sarah. Discussion. I'd like to start with, I had on the table a set of meeting minutes that has yellow on it. There should be one for all the members that are here. And I'm taking off the lead off of discussion because these are my comments and they were too extensive to actually say just orally. Let me walk you through them. They're relatively simple. First, attendees. Connor McGrath was listed as a member. As you'll recall, last meeting he had not yet officially been elected, so we need to move him to others present. Also absent was Monet Dumas. Excused is not the right term. She should just be added to the absent line. Under the Faculty Senate report, I clarified that Jay Burns was not present, so there was no report, but I, on his behalf, mentioned that they had finalized their recommendations on Hope Plaza. Under Section 4, I clarified it was the Executive Committee who passed Resolution 16 over the summer, which is why we were reporting on it to the members at the first meeting.
Where? I'm sorry, what?
On Section 4, top of page 2.
Yep.
It previously said, so it was approved formally over the summer, I clarified, by the UA Executive Committee.
Okay.
In Section 6, new business, you did take a vote by unanimous consent to approve the schedule for this year. On Section 3, this is the big section in yellow, this is an actual, taken from the presentation, the actual recommendations that were referred by you to the subsequent committees and members. The draft minutes did not list them, they just said the recommendations were approved. They needed to be in the minutes, and so I've included them here. And I have the source document if anybody would like to see it and compare it. And then you did formally take a vote that was passed 11-0-1 to refer those recommendations to the committees. Are there questions on my recommended changes to the minutes? Are there other recommended changes to the minutes? Hearing none, can I have a motion to pass the minutes? Or do I already have that? I guess I have that, right?
I did that before, and then made changes, so I'm not sure what...
So may I request a motion to approve the minutes with the changes as put in front of you? Bridget? Alex, seconds? All in favor? Can I see hands... I see 11. Opposed? Abstain? Motion carries. The minutes are approved. The next item of business is report from the assemblies. Ulysses, may I hear a report from the student assembly?
For the most part, we've been doing more administrative work. We just passed our diversity and inclusion plan, something we started doing last year. Continuation of those, so three of the initiatives we completed last year, two of them are rolling over this year, and DC Cameron Fisher will be overseeing that. For the past couple of weeks, we've been intensely debating the formation of a university student court, an entity that is completely separate from the assembly and separate from the other judicial bodies here. We worked with Mary Beth on it, the Chinese Institute, and we did talk with the ombudsman last year to get feedback from Michael. It actually took about a year. So now it's actually being debated. It will handle judicial cases that are students, student organization disputes, and those disputes involving the assembly itself. If there are only non-code of conduct issues, whether it's anything else, just any other board around here. So that's been a debate, and it will probably likely carry over to 50.
On behalf of the assembly, congratulations on the elections you oversaw, and I saw your picture on the masthead yesterday. It was a good picture, and I think I also saw President Scorton accepted some of your resolutions recently, so excellent. Thank you. Graduate Professional Student Assembly, Monet Dumas is not here. Alex, do you have a report for them?
Not really. We've been talking about professionalism activities. We had a presentation by the Director of CAPS, so Counseling and Psychological Services. Seems like staffing is going well. Most of the slots are filled, or at least filled past where we were last year.
All slots are now filled.
So I think that's about it. We haven't really considered too many new resolutions. The graduate student activity fee is up for reapproval this year, so we'll start doing that soon.
Excellent. Thank you. Employee Assembly, Bridget?
Thank you, Jim. On October 1st, the president addressed staff. There was about 400 people in attendance. It went very well. The big news was that the president announced a gift of $25,000 to the Employee Care Fund. It was running in a deficit, and it has brought it back into the black, and there's some money there. Moving forward, the assembly is working hard to come up with fundraising options. In particular, we're hoping to get the fund endowed. That may be a big battle. Meanwhile, we're also working on continuing efforts to have contributions that can be made through payroll deduction, and working hard on those efforts to try to get that fund stabilized for the coming years. We have one empty seat in the non-expense side that we are recruiting for membership. Thank you.
You were meeting with Mary Opperman about some of our academic appointments that aren't faculty. Is there anything you want to report regarding that? Okay. Faculty Senate, I note Joe Burns is not here and he did not submit a report to me. Do any of our faculty colleagues have a report from the Faculty Senate?
I'm trying to remember what we actually went over. That's right. We actually did go over the response. We were actually reviewing it.
Okay, thank you. Committee updates. Executive Committee, first I would like to report to the Assembly that UA Resolution 16 was adopted by President Scorton. This is the appointment of the Hearing and Review Board members that we sent him earlier this year. It also contains some provisions for making summer appointments when HRB members are not fully available, may not be fully available. There was a question asked at the last meeting about who approves HRB members, meaning the context of that question was whether we approve them or whether we approve them, and it requires acceptance by President Scorton before they are appointed. It does not require acceptance by President Scorton. So it has fully been delegated to us, and it is a courtesy notification to him. However, regarding UA Resolution 16, the summer appointment process did require his acceptance. Second, I mentioned last meeting that my position at the policy as the policy advisory group liaison for the University Assembly, I needed to vacate that now that I am the chair due to conflict of interest. At the end of that meeting, Ellis Lowe volunteered as long as the schedule worked for him. We've confirmed that the schedule does work for him, and I also conferred with our EA colleagues to see make sure that everything was okay from their side. It is, and so the executive committee has appointed Dr. Lowe to serve as the policy advisor group liaison for this academic year. Next, the campus planning committee has submitted a request to the executive committee to change our bylaws regarding their organization. They are established in our bylaws. We're reviewing that request. Basically, it's going back to the future, I guess is what I would say. They want to readopt what the Manning and setup they had 2 years ago. It worked better for them, they say. We're looking at that. We'll bring forth a resolution or not at a future meeting after we've had a time to fully digest what they're requesting and the logic of it. And finally, I'd like to say my sincere appreciation to the EASA and GPSA. All of your vacancies on the UA and the UA standing committees are filled. I know that that was a big effort, and thank you very much. Connor, we welcome you officially to the Assembly. I would note my disappointment in Faculty Senate representation. We are one member short of the Faculty Senate from the UA main body, one short on the Campus Infrastructure Committee, two short on the Campus Welfare Committee, two short on the Codes and Judicial Committee. Six total vacancies. I have taken that up with the Dean of Faculty, and we'll see what we get. In the meantime, committees do have faculty members from this body on them, and I encourage you all to move forward and take out, and, you know, take charge and move out, whatever the proper term is. And hopefully we won't do anything that the faculties will object to in their absence on our committees. David, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, just one thing on top of that. I just want to thank Alex. Alex and I presented at the GPSA meeting, and so he did a pretty good job just getting me squared away since I'm new to present. So thanks for your help getting people signed up.
Next, the Campus Infrastructure Committee. George Ruiz Calderon, the chair of that committee, was called away at the last minute. He has apparently been given two interviews today for positions, and so he felt that that was a more compelling need to be there, and I guess I had a hard time fighting with him over it. But he did send me this report that the CIC will be meeting Wednesdays at 5 p.m. starting next Wednesday, he says. I don't know what that means, tomorrow or a week from tomorrow. The context implied a week from tomorrow. And that he has already drafted up a revised resolution 4 on affordable housing that he will take up with the committee at their next meeting. Campus Welfare Committee, Alex?
First off, I attended the leadership breakfast in your place. A number of other people were there. One issue that came up that is relevant to CWC is what role Gannett Health sees himself playing in employee health. So this is a question that Greg asked and something that Bridget also emphasized during the CWC meeting that we had a few weeks ago, understanding what their mission regarding employee health is. We had our first meeting a few weeks ago. We don't have a regular meeting time, so I apologize for the survey fatigue to all the CWC members. We're planning on, I'm hopefully planning another meeting in about 2 weeks. Our first meeting, we went over the incident management team report. So that was a report issued last year in response to bias cases. So some good news on that front. There's a new council on sexual violence prevention. Their first meeting was on October 2nd. I attended. Professor Booker also attended. It is a large body of about 30 people, spanning staff and students and also higher level administrators. They'll start breaking up and working on specific policy recommendations soon. In addition, the University Diversity Council, in conjunction with the Office of Institutional Research and Planning, has been issuing campus climate surveys. And this data has actually been released as well. If you Google Cornell Institutional Research and Planning, you'll go to their website and actually have a lot of really nice applets that show the results for different questions that they've surveyed the student population. So do you feel comfortable expressing your opinion with people from other backgrounds, agree, disagree, or not? And you can break that down by ethnicity, social class, gender, and they have a preliminary report that I just found today that I haven't read through, but they're planning on hiring an outside consultant. It is Professor Sylvia Hurtado from who's the Director of Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA to figure out how to use this information. So that's also good news that they're moving on that. One issue that we identified in the incident management team report was that most of the recommendations focus on undergraduate students. There are programs regarding Title IX and sexual harassment complaints for employees, but this isn't required for all employees, required on a department-by-department basis. In addition, there's no requirement for graduate students. And so this is, personally, I think that that's very important because 40% of graduate students are international and probably don't have an idea of what Title IX is or the protections afforded to them. Also, since we are in positions of authority, we could be called upon to report Title IX violations. And if we don't, I believe that we could be held, action could be taken against graduate students who do not report Title IX infractions. So I think it could be important to pursue this further. And then finally, we also talked some about other issues on campus, so program housing, overcrowding and on-campus housing, particularly on North Campus, and also high-risk behavior and alcohol consumption in college towns could be considered campus welfare issues that we could look at. And then finally, Ulysses mentioned that the SA passed a diversity plan for their assembly.
Yes, we did.
Last year there was talk about whether or not the university assembly needed a diversity plan. We discussed this a little bit, and it seems consensus-wise that we don't feel that the university assembly needs a diversity plan for recruitment since we take our members from the constituent assemblies. But we can consider that further if you want a more official opinion. So that's the principal.
I leave that to members, and if you want to put that to them at a future meeting,
okay,
please do. Code and Judicial Committee, Greg.
So we're going to have a lot of work to do in a short period of time. The meetings are usually lively, so we'll try to be as organized and concise and clear in advance of those meetings as possible. We will start next week, the week after this one that we're currently in. It looks like tentatively our meeting times are going to be Tuesday at the lunchtime hour, the 12 to 1 period. But I just need to confirm with some key members at that meeting whose attendance is critical on some issues. So more official meeting time notification will be sent out. I would encourage just the other assemblies just to make sure that as you're appointing people to go through the appointment system as opposed to the introductions via the email, that's the best way to keep those things up to date. So if you just go back to your appointment process, it would be awesome. But a lot of things from last year, sort of cleaning up some of those little pieces that got left on the table and some other things regarding some conversations we'll have today and probably throughout the semester.
And you'll note in the minutes the actual referral. You were not at the last meeting, I know, and so the meeting minutes contain the actual referrals to your committee such that they are to date. Any questions for any of the committees? Hearing none, then turning to new business. I'd like to welcome first Professor Almendinger, who will give us a presentation on the ad hoc committee's report and recommendations on the Hope Plaza incident, followed by a question and answer period. Since we don't have a throng of visitors, that'll probably be a relatively informal Q&A. But if all of a sudden protesters march into the meeting, well, we'll take control and handle questions to the chair. Welcome, Professor Almendinger, and the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you.
Oh, I get it. It's a.
Would you like them a little more close?
I am wisely prepared for the graphics that Jim asked me to make with a black background and white text. Not well suited to this year. Well, first of all, thank you all very much. My fellow committee members, Margaret Washington of History Department and Bill Pratt of Science, and I appreciate the opportunity to present our report to the University Assembly today. Phil was, Margaret was on sabbatical, and Phil was a department chair, and therefore has many other meetings and other patients, so has been said he may or may not be here this afternoon. So first is preliminary. The charge to our committee from the faculty and senate was substantially broader and more detailed than the charge to the Lingle and Miller report that was commissioned by President Scorton about the same incident. And so, in this way, our report is, I believe, complementary to their report. And in fact, we find have the same basic finding that the Lingle and Miller report had, that everybody involved in this particular incident felt like, thought they were doing the right thing. There was no intent to infringe upon anyone's liberties or anything like that during the course of this incident. Our purpose, and this was important, was to study the university response to the Hotalka incident and not to take sides on the Israeli-Palestine conflict. And some of the criticisms of the report from some people had suggested that it was, for example, we used the word Gaza in the report, but not Israel, and so on. We were explicitly trying not to get into the political aspects of that very thorny issue at all. I think the success of our success in doing that can be seen by the fact that I still have no idea where either Margaret or Bill stand on the Israeli-Palestine conflict. I have no idea what their political standing is. None of the committee members were present on the Hope Plaza on the 19th, so therefore our report is based on interviews, mostly from firsthand participants, and also some secondhand reports, and also trying to filter media issues and videos on YouTube and things like that. And importantly, you should realize, of course, that none of the committee members has any experience in investigations of this type. We had no official standing in the university. We were not a body to which to take formal complaints to. Everybody that we interviewed, we told them that they should take their formal complaints. We could advise them on where to go to register any formal complaints related to this incident. Our purpose was to get a general view of the university response to the incident rather than to take explicit complaints. Nonetheless, as those of you who have read the report will see, probably our inexperience shows in certain aspects of questions we didn't ask, things we didn't follow up on, and so on. So we interviewed more than 20 people, 17 of whom were directly involved in the events on Hope Plaza on November 19th. I have to say, everyone was extremely cooperative and open with us, willing to talk with us from the Cornell police officers through the staff members who were involved, through the students and faculty and so on. So we felt that we received quite a lot of collaboration from them. This should be obvious and sure is obvious to everybody in this room, but different people see the same events through very, very different lenses. And a lot of what we had to do was to try and filter different accounts of the same incidences and reconcile those accounts. And most of what appear in our report is confirmed by at least two different people that we interviewed with. There were a number of statements that were made from a single individual that was difficult for us to parse and know how to put it in context. And so some of the more, shall I say, inflammatory things that we heard were not put into the report for that reason.
We also interviewed two faculty experts on academic freedom. We interviewed the judicial administrator and the chair of the Advanced Management Planning Team, or EMPT. And again, they were all very, very helpful to us in trying to figure out what actually went on during that time. Now, any of you who served on a committee knows that any committee report is a compromise, and this report is no different than any other report. I will try, I'm here to represent the official committee report to the University Assembly. I will try to tell you if any personal opinions or whatever slip in and try to differentiate those from the committee report if necessary. And as I've already said, in general we would agree with the conclusions of the Nimble Awards report. So let me run through a timeline for the events to the run-up to the November 19th event, because this gives some background and context for what happened, how it played out on November 19th. You can see there are, you know, things that Cornell did, things that the SJP did, that is the Students for Justice in Palestine organization, and CPAC, the Cornell Israeli Public Action Committee, who were the principal participants in the event. On Wednesday of the preceding week, that is, this is the week before Thanksgiving, SJP began to plan their rally on Hofaza for that Monday. We have confirmation of that from multiple emails from people involved and so on. This coincided relatively closely with the very recent escalation of tensions in Gaza that happened in that week. We are less certain of exactly when CPAC actually began planning their event on Hope Plaza. We don't have the emails to follow up on. It's our understanding that the event management planning team has a weekly meeting on Thursdays, and at the time they met on this weekly meeting, neither group had submitted or expressed any intention publicly to rally on Hope Plaza via the university use of university property protocol at that time. And so at that time, the AMPT was apparently not aware that anything was planned. A lot happened on Friday of the week. The SJP announced publicly a rally at 9:08 a.m. on Facebook. And furthermore, they were present on Hope Plaza at noontime, distributing quarter cards announcing their rally on Hope Plaza at that time. On Friday afternoon, two things happened. First, at 2:48, an event manager emailed the SJP for more information about their rally. They received no response from the SJP. SJP leadership declared that they saw no need to inform Cornell of their rally because the code of conduct explicitly permits this activity, and furthermore, they were philosophically opposed to the UUP process. At 2:52, CPAC filed a UUP for an event on Hope Plaza at the same time that apparently the SJP had already been publicly advertising an event. But they went through proper channels. They filed a UUP and so on. Interestingly enough, you note that these two times are extremely close. We were unable to follow up on whether there was any connection or not. The first public announcement that we could find of the CPAC rally on Hope Plaza was actually at 10:10 p.m. on Saturday, posting on CPAC's webpage for a public event. They may have announced the event prior to that via some of their listservs, but again, we did not acquire the information for that.
Do you want questions by the slide or at the end?
What do you think?
I'm sorry, I did not hear the question.
Questions at the time as I go through this or at the end?
Which one you prefer? I can do it either way.
It's up to you, sir.
It'll take longer if I take questions, but go ahead.
What kind of information did you get about the coincidence in the time between the 248 and the 252?
All UUPs are timestamped, and we have that information from Student Activities Office at 252, and we have the SJP leader gave us a copy of the email from the Cornell Event Manager, which was stamped at 248. On Friday afternoon. So there is, all we know is that there's a very close time coincidence between these two. We cannot say if there's a connection or not. Other questions on this time frame? So while I'm back on this slide, let me just say that one of the participants in the CPAC rally, one of the participants explicitly told us that the CPAC rally and fire and filing of the UUP was a preemptive countermeasure to the already planned SJP event. So we heard that first. We subsequently interviewed the leadership of CPAC, and neither of the two leaders of CPAC that we interviewed would confirm that that was indeed the case, and said they said that it was not the case. They simply identified Monday of the week of Thanksgiving because everybody goes home on Tuesday for Thanksgiving. So that is, we have conflicting evidence from different participants in the CPAC rally about that. But the timing and the lack of any information up until that point does suggest to us that probably the SJP, the CPAC filing of the UUP, was in response to the SJP announcement to have a public rally at that time. But we can't confirm that. That is hearsay, I guess. Use of university property plays a key issue in this event, and one which I'm sure that the UA will take up in some detail. Almost all university officials, of course, regard the UUP as a form of permit to use university space and so on. The one exception to that was the Associate Dean of Students, Catherine Holmes, who is in charge of student activities, and she said that she regarded it as a notification only rather than a permit process. However, UUPs, if those of you who have been involved with that process, and frankly most faculty haven't, certainly requires approval and goes down a chain of many different people who pass on any particular UUP filing and so on. The UUP, I don't believe, is mentioned in the Code of Conduct, but is posted here at this website. The policy on that website says that 3 weeks notice are required for a permit. We were told by Catherine Holmes that of the 3,000 or more UUP requests that are processed yearly, most are received less than 3 weeks in advance, and UUP requests are rarely rejected. We found no evidence that the CPAC UUP request was in any way, quote unquote, fast tracked, or that there was any explicit attempt on the part of the university officials handling that to accelerate that process beyond what is normally done. The 3 weeks in advance appears to be widely not used or not followed. The other big issue, for those of you who have read the report, is the use of amplified sound. The policy regarding amplified sound is found in the Student Activities Handbook, which is located at this webpage. It also does not appear in the Code of Conduct or any other thing, and as you'll see, it is a source of disagreement amongst the members of the committee, whole Plaza Faculty Committee. The CPAC UUP specified the use of amplified sound, and as we've always seen, SAP did not file a UUP at all. All Cornell officials stated that the use of amplified sound without a UUP permit was the main reason for deciding to try to remove SJP from the plaza, because SJP was using a megaphone. They did not have permission to use a megaphone. CPAC was on the plaza. They did have permission to use a to use a sound system, and so on. Several CU staff, including CUP officers, stated that the SJP could have stayed on the plaza without the use of amplified sound. They were within their rights to appear on the plaza, to appear as a counter-protest to the CPAC rally, but without the use of amplified sound. And some of that group even stated that if CPAC had not already filed a UUP for Hope Plaza, and if the SJP had just showed up with their megaphone, that they would have been permitted to carry out their rally, even though it was not technically aligned with Cornell University regulations. Okay, the November 19th rallies, obviously, this is, I'm sure, no surprise to this group, but it's probably a surprise to many faculty members that the university monitors virtually all public events with event managers and police officers. This makes total sense. The role of event managers is particularly unknown to faculty at the university. I assume it's better known to this group, but event managers, for those of you who are unfamiliar with them, are usually non-academic staff who, outside of their normal duties, or in addition to their normal duties, have worked with, I believe it's Susan Murphy's office, to monitor and help manage and control events on campus. And we should recognize that the event managers are doing something extra outside of what they're doing. They're doing something extra for the university, and this is actually a laudable effort because it's not really mandated by their work. Nonetheless, as we'll see, we believe that a critical mistake by an event manager changed the course of this event in some unfortunate way. So CPAC was the first to arrive on the plaza. They had a large sound system. The SJP group assembled a group of about 75 people on the art squad and then marched to Hope Plaza. They had a small megaphone, but by all accounts, there were more people in the SJP rally than there were in the CPAC rally. So now we have two groups who are definitely not friends of each other, both trying to occupy Hope Plaza, both with amplified sound, and so on. Relatively early on after SJP arrived on Hope Plaza, CPAC did ask the event managers and the police to remove SJP from the plaza. On the other hand, they were not immediately removed from the plaza. So, but an event manager did approach the SJP leader and asked him to stop using the megaphone. This request was ignored. The SJP leader told us directly that they were they felt that it was fully within their rights and they didn't have to justify it to anybody to use amplified sound on Hope Plaza. From a couple of different reports that we have, the event manager called an administrative assistant in Day Hall to confirm the policy regarding amplified sound. And then, perhaps in what I personally believe, and I believe the rest of the committee would cite this as an important step, police officers on the plaza received incorrect information from one of the two event managers who was on the plaza that the SJP leader was not affiliated with Cornell. The SJP leader, the person on the megaphone, is in fact a Cornell graduate student in good standing and a member of the Cornell community. This event appears to have changed the tenor of the interaction between the police and the SJP leaders and fellow protesters and so on, because now instead of saying, well, you may, you know, you'll have to appear before the judicial administrator, they were told, or the SJP leader was told, that some 30 to 40 minutes into the rally, that he would be arrested for trespassing on Cornell property. And this statement, which was confirmed by several police officers and by the SJ and two or three people in the SJP leadership, was enough to prompt the SJP to leave the plaza, because as the SJP leader said to it, there's a big difference between an appearance before the judicial administrator and being taken downtown and booked for arrest. And so on. The SJP also told us that by this time they had accomplished what they wanted to, and they decided to, at that point, to leave the plaza and march to Day Hall. The Cornell police shut off, because it's East Avenue, so that SJP could march safely to Day Hall, you know, and not have any traffic accidents, and so on. During the process of this interaction between the police and the SJP, scuffles ensued. A student was knocked to the ground. We have very conflicting reports on this. We cannot say exactly what happened. One of the Cornell police officers told us that a student repeatedly charged him while he was trying to talk with the SJP leader, and on the third charge, a charge meaning running at him, trying to sort of push him or tackle him or whatever out of the way, he, as he said, directed the student, a woman, to the side, and he didn't know what happened to her. The student, we talked to the student who was knocked to the ground, she said she was knocked to the ground by the police, but she was pushed from behind, so she didn't actually know who had knocked her to the ground. So we can't tell whether these two events are the same or different or whatever, and we just have to, we just put both accounts into our report. The reason why the Faculty Senate asked for a committee to investigate this event probably is mostly to do with faculty, the CUP interaction with faculty who were present on the scene, and in particular faculty who were supporting the SJP side of the rally rather than the faculty who supported the CPAC side of the rally. Experts on academic freedom that we consulted, one from the law school, one from ILR, affirmed that faculty participation in events like the Hope Plaza conflict was do come under the umbrella of academic freedom. Frankly, several of us on the committee didn't at first think that it had much to do with academic freedom. Free speech, yes, but not academic freedom, but we were schooled by these experts that this was in fact an academic freedom issue, because it can be thought of as a normal part of faculty activity to participate in the dialogue and discourse of the university. One of the contentious issues between the police and the faculty was that this police demanded to see the ID cards of several of the faculty members at the rally. Some of the faculty members responded in a very heated fashion and were clearly upset by this request. CUP feels that it's completely within their right to do so, because every single ID card, the ID cards that all of you have, that's on my card and so on, states that this card must be carried at all times and is to be shown for identification on request. And so the police felt that it was fully within their right to ask for faculty ID at the event. Moving on to the committee recommendations, and these are very abbreviated form. You have the more extended form in the report. We feel that the phrase on campus ID cards reading is to be shown for identification on the request should be eliminated, or more probably, it should be clarified what that means. Cornell University, despite the fact we have people from all over the world coming onto Cornell, and virtually anybody can walk across the Cornell campus, it's our understanding that Cornell is considered private property. And so Cornell can set whatever regulations it wants in this regard. It is our understanding, but we are far from experts on this, that in a truly public space, a police officer cannot ask for identification except on suspicion of misbehavior of some sort. Now, you may be able to clarify that.
I think you said that very accurately.
And so this is the difference between a private space being Cornell property and a public space. If we apply the public approach to the events on Hope Plaza, and if Hope Plaza had been public space and not a private space, it probably would not have been within the bounds of the police to ask for faculty identification at the event. So this is a key issue of the public versus private space. So this needs to be clarified in some way. The faculty's right to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly and academic freedom should take priority over their acting as agents of the university. This is a tricky one, frankly, and I'm going to inject some personal opinion here. Obviously, faculty who are in administrative positions, and since I've served as an associate dean before, I'm well aware of this, that sometimes your administrative position may cause you to come into conflict with some of your personal political beliefs and so on. It is also an issue with respect to the recent Title IX information and the training that we've had to go through and Title IX, because in some case, one could imagine a faculty member deciding that freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, one could envision cases where that might be in conflict with the Title IX requirements and so on. But nonetheless, we feel that the freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, academic freedom should be highlighted, and they already are, but they should be continue to be highlighted. The right to ad hoc assembly for the purpose of free speech and expression without the necessity of filing EUP notification, we felt should be preserved and protected. However, the next bullet point is one of the areas where the Hope Plaza Committee could not agree. We could not reach unanimity on the question of whether a permit or notification should be necessary for the use of amplified sound. And so our recommendation presents two options. The first option is that relatively in concert with existing university policy, where two groups wish to use the same outdoor space at the same time for competing purposes, the group that notified the university of their intent to use amplified sound first via UUP process should be the only group to use amplified sound. The other strong opinion on the faculty committee was that any use of amplified sound at a reasonable decibel level in connection with rallies, protests, and demonstration infringes on the right to free expression even if the sole purpose of the counter protest is to drown out and prevent the original protest from being heard. I will say that these two contrasting views were also reflected in the two experts on academic freedom that we consulted during our meetings, with one basically calling on this option, and the other strongly expressing for this option here. So this will be a thorny issue for you to decide this year.
Yes. Could you go into the reasons that each side took to say this is the right way to go versus that
way?
Well,
the side that chose this option basically followed the university policy for visiting speakers who might be expressing unpopular points of view. Say, Karl Rove was on campus a couple of years ago, and we've had a variety of controversial visiting speakers. And the university policy for, I'm not sure about outdoor talks, but indoor talks, is that you may protest, but you can't obstruct people's view, and you can't drown out the speaker. The committee members who favored this option felt that that was a good policy, that was in the best interest of academic discourse and dialogue, and so on. The committee members who favored this option felt that simply any attempt to transgress on the right to protest and demonstrate would be an infringement on free speech, and that that they felt that this was the sole purpose was to drown out the original protest from being heard. That was an unfortunate consequence of free speech, but free speech was valuable enough that there had to be a strong statement.
So even if it meant the majority could drown out the views of the minority, forbidding them from actually expressing their views.
Right. Well, one key here is a reasonable decibel level.
whatever that means. Yeah.
So
there's no real set point for that. So that's
correct.
So it's interesting that the one that supposedly is protecting free speech is setting up a situation where free speech could be denied.
That's correct. Yeah. So we had these two options that were, and there are only three members of the committee,
yeah.
So and we could not reach agreement on these two points.
But could you go back to your first recommendation? I mean, I also think this is interesting because, I mean, I can't think of any campus I've ever been on in which the university would be willing to give up that particular privilege. I mean, a good example would be if we were, let's say, at Johns Hopkins at the medical school, where everyone must check in and show their ID. Most staff and faculty and students would actually go, that's a good thing.
Right, and you can imagine all sorts of ways it would be a good thing. You want to take a book out of the library, you have to identify yourself. It's something as simple as that.
And that's actually what's going to be the next one. That means if they ask me to show my ID to take a book out, I don't have to, but I guess in order to comply with the rule. But
right, but the issue here is really, and the reason why it needs clarification is if, you know, in this particular incident, it was not clear to the faculty who were involved in the protests why they should show their IDs, and several of them state that they felt that a police officer asking them to show their IDs when they were conducting, they were not breaking any laws, they were simply attending and basically standing on the edge of a protest, not being in the middle of it, not obstructing police officers in any way, is my understanding. They felt that for the police to ask them for their IDs under that situation was an act of intimidation.
Inappropriate.
Intimidation was the word that was used by the faculty who were involved in that.
Okay.
for the sake of time, let's let Ms. Armendinger get to his fifth recommendation and sum up so that we can get to the UFC's response.
So number five, there was a critical mistake made in the committee's view by an event manager at the scene. We had no reason to believe that it was a purposeful mistake or anything else. But the fact that an event manager mistakenly told the police that the leader of the SJP was not a member of the Cornell community significantly changed the dynamic on the plaza that day, in our view. And these things can happen, but this was one of the sources of tension on the plaza that day. And so we asked the Catherine Holmes, who works closely with event managers, deployed for various events around campus, to whether event managers received very much training. We were told that in general they did not receive very much training. Certainly not training in handling very tense issues such as ensued between these two groups who really didn't like each other on both plaza on the 19th. So we suggest that they receive more training in how to handle these events and so on. We're less familiar with the training that the police receives. I'm sure that the police receive more and different training related to crowd control and so on. Likewise, you'll notice, and here I will inject my personal opinion, we noted that the only people who perceived the event to have any potential for actual violent confrontation were the police and the event managers. On the other hand, the police are probably the only people who are trained to anticipate that sort of thing, whereas everyone else can't believe that a crowd can suddenly go berserk or whatever. Now, this is my personal opinion, and it's not necessarily the opinion of the committee, but to the extent that training isn't already done, and we didn't go deeply into what training is already done, there should be more training for handling events like this, particularly for the event managers who, again, this is not part of their portfolio. They're doing this out of a willingness to help the university community and so on, and they should be given the tools to be effective at that job. So that's all I have to say. I'd be willing to take any more questions, or we can go on.
We're a little over time in this presentation,
USA.
But I believe that Greg Meese has a question.
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
And several that came up in the CJC's discussion last year. One, who were the experts on academic freedom, and were they involved in any way in the rallies themselves?
Neither one of them were involved in the rally themselves, the two experts. In general, I don't want to cite individual names, but in this case, the two experts, I don't see any problem with this since they weren't involved, Steve Schifrin of the law school and Risa Lieberitz of the ILR school.
And then my next, I guess one of the things I'm concerned with is a little bit of the tenor and tone of the recommendation, because there's a part on page 7 where you talk about, and page 8-2, the unnecessary escalation. Was that the faculty member's unnecessary escalation when asked for ID, or was that CUPD's unnecessary escalation? Because the way it reads is that the CUPD, working within the rights of their current policies and procedures, did something wrong, when really it was the unwillingness of the faculty member to cooperate with current university policy that created the unnecessary escalation. So I guess my concern is that there's a little bit of a tone and tenor that everybody else but faculty did wrong. And then my next question would be, did any of the groups do anything wrong as it relates to current university property or university policy and procedure?
Well, as I stated at the beginning, to answer the last question first, we basically feel that
as the Mingle and Miller report concluded, that everybody felt they were doing the right thing. There is ambiguity, however, so that ambiguity permitted the SJP to feel they were perfectly within their right to be on Hope Plaza with amplified sound without filing a UUP. And that is why this whole issue is coming before you. Obviously your role to work that out, and I expect you will have some spirited discussions in doing that. As I mentioned at the beginning, the tenor of the report reflects a compromise view, as all committee reports do, some of us on the report feel that the tenor was more negative than it should have been. Others felt that it was not negative enough. So this, for better or worse, was a compromised view of the incidents. And I should say, it was a committee of faculty convened by the Faculty Senate, not a general investigative body to look at it. So it so the report naturally has a faculty-centric view. I think there's probably some wisdom in having the CJC be the one to look at the code rather than the Faculty Senate alone to look at the code.
And I guess my one other question would be, a lot of this is hanging on the mistake of the risk manager, event manager who was involved. I guess my question was, when the SJP leader was basically said you're not affiliated with Cornell, did they do anything to clarify the situation and say, no, actually I'm a grad student, here's my ID card, there's no issue, I'm not affiliated, or was it the resistance to authority in that moment that then escalated it? So is it really the fault? I'm guessing, did the person involved make any attempts to clarify that they were affiliated with the university so that that misinformation couldn't continue down the path it continued down?
We were told that the SJP leader refused to speak any more to either the event manager or the police after the first interaction between the event manager and the police, and the SJP leader at the beginning of the event.
So then is that really the mistake of the events manager who tried to seek correct information but was essentially stonewalled by the person in question and not given any, so they had to go with what they assumed to be true? So how is that a critical mistake?
Well, our understanding, which actually 3 months after the event was told to us both by the police officers involved and the event manager, they believed right up to that point that the leader was not affiliated with Cornell. There was, even after the fact, there was no attempt to confirm or deny that particular issue. We tried to stay away to the extent we could from motives, because we don't understand those very well. We tried to be relatively factual, and the fact is an event manager gave the police incorrect information about the affiliation of the student. It's our understanding it wasn't a, I think he's not as affiliated. It was more of a, I've seen that person at other rallies and he's not affiliated with Cornell, more of a declarative statement in that case. I don't actually know whether, and this is where our own inability to investigate clearly and so on follows up, I don't actually know whether the police tried to ask for the student, the SJP leader's ID card or not at that time.
Thank you very much for a very thorough rundown of your committee report.
Probably
appreciate it. Because of the time I need in the meeting, I would like to introduce Justin David Pelletier. While he's setting up briefly, let me clarify again for members who may not fully understand this. The ad hoc committee was commissioned by the faculty senate. The report that you've just seen was presented to the faculty senate. So it is not does not comprise the faculty senate's recommendations. This was the committee's report to the faculty senate. Now Professor Pelletier, who is a member of the UFC, will tell us what the faculty senate has actually put forward as their view of what should be done in response to this event.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Clearly the... It's not there yet.
You may have to switch it from remote to desktop. There's a button on the left-hand touchscreen. There it is.
There you go. Thank you. So clearly the ad hoc committee did the heavy lifting on this one, and the UFC was simply asked to respond to their recommendations. So we took their chronology and their report of the incident as it unfolded as given, and simply responding to the five recommendations. So in terms of the overall report, we generally endorsed it and considered it balanced and excellent. Excellent report to try to reconstruct a difficult situation. So the UFC has passed the faculty report in total to the UACJC for revision of campus code and reconciliation with the UUP process as appropriate. And the UFC response was given to the faculty senate just September 11th of this year. Okay. So with respect to the five specific recommendations on the ID cards, UFC's response is that there should be a phrase retained, but it should be reworded to clarify the situations in which the card must be shown upon request. And this gets into all sorts of legal issues, so we recommended that they involve, the University Council be involved. University Council has been notified, and they're working on it as of an email dated September 17th of this year. Okay, so that recommendation has been forwarded to them. Regarding the faculty as agents of the universities, as opposed to faculty expressing their free speech, we feel, as the committee did, that faculty free expression trumps their role as agents, and that this should be highlighted in CUP training. This response has been forwarded to the Vice President for Human Resources on September 17th of this year. She has acknowledged and agreed with this recommendation on September 27th. She also provided language showing that in the CUP training manual, this right of faculty to free speech is very clearly made in the training of the CUP. Along the way, the University Council also wanted to parse the language related to academic freedom that's in the ad hoc committee's report. And University Council wants to simply note that there are three contexts for faculty academic freedom. One is in the classroom, and one is in their research, and the other is participate in peaceful assembly and protest such as these. And in the first two, we are in fact acting as agents of the university. But when we are in peaceful assembly and protest and so on, we cannot be compelled to act in that capacity. So we can act just like a student or staff member or anyone else in that context. So University Council had asked that clarification be appended to the ad hoc committee's report. UFC felt that wasn't appropriate, but that clarification is available. I think, Jim, you have it, and it needs to be sort of on the table when UACJC takes up these issues. Regarding the notification procedure, the UFC feels that the right to spontaneous assembly must be preserved, but at the same time, there's a equally legitimate a value of preserving public safety and indeed an obligation to preserve public safety. And so UFC is trying to find a common sense middle ground, which is that advance notice is desirable and to be encouraged, but should not be mandatory. And UFC recommends that, again, CJC and the Assembly should remove ambiguities between the UUP and the campus code. And so it's referred this to this body. On amplified sound, the UFC feels that the goal of the final campus code should be to encourage civil discourse reflecting the diverse values in the university community. That's the paramount interest, according to us. Most members feel that the question of restrictions on amplified sound should be addressed by university assembly. A few members feel that this item is too narrow and that the code should remain at a higher level. The issues of how one would specify that set point, how one would monitor and enforce decibel levels and distance from the amplification and all of the rest gets very hairy very fast. So it's certainly beyond us, and some members, a few members of the UFC felt even the code itself maybe doesn't want to wade into that level of technical detail. But nonetheless, it's been referred to the assembly. Regarding training for the CUP and event managers, we agree on the training for both. We also noted it would be worthwhile encouraging faculty involvement in that training of event managers and possibly police, so that the faculty perspectives can be communicated directly and perhaps make more of an impression in the training process than if it was a different set of staff trainers alone. So Student and Academic Services has been notified of this desire, and they have acknowledged that on September 17th. Yes.
Do the few members that feel that felt that there shouldn't be, that any mention of amplified sound shouldn't be included in the code, believe that being able to drown out others' free speech was just more important?
No, what we were unanimous on was the first one, that the ultimate goal is to promote civil discourse, which would imply not allowing the drowning out of each other.
Anyone unanimous?
Yes, that's the part we were unanimous on.
So if I can clarify, you're referring, formally we have referred to the University Assembly, the campus code issue, clarifying between the UUP process and the campus code, just whatever is the agreed on solution, make sure there's no disconnects between the two. There's the larger issue of amplified sound, whether it should be in the code or not is one issue, and then, but if it's going to be in the code, somebody's got to tackle it. Either it be perhaps the UUP or the code itself needs to tackle it. But you handed that over to us for the next set of recommendations. On recommendation 5, training for CUP and event managers, I would note that I have received via Joe Burns an email from Mary Opperman stating what Professor Pelletier had said, that they do agree that training is important. And I asked Kathy Gunner earlier today the status of CUP training, and I believe that if we have time at the end, that she's got that handout and may want to give us 1 or 2 minutes just to update us on the factual training involved in that. My view, and I believe the view of the faculty senate, is the training of the CUP and event managers is really not in our job jar, other than to see that these conflicts are followed up on and removed and that reasonable solutions have been thought about. I'm not sure there's a perfect solution out there, so to find the best solution as possible. Sir, can I ask you to go back to your first slide really briefly? Campus ID cards, I have an email from Joe Burns also that he forwarded from Jim Mingle, the University Council. And I'll quote from this email. He said, thank you for sharing the UFC's comments and recommendations in response to the faculty special committee report via the whole class of incident. He says, as requested, he will review the first recommendation regarding the statement on 8 cards, and he will get back to the dean of faculty on his ultimate thoughts. So exactly what those will be, and depending on what they are, how they'll be implemented, is still to be determined. I think our role, the University Assembly's role in that, is just to monitor it, to see that there's resolution on the issue, and that it seems, at some level, common sense, common sense approach to however they view the issue itself. It's not really our issue unless others bring it forth and say they completely and utterly disagree. And I do know that the UUP issue has been referred to Catherine. Kathy is owner, can you help me? Catherine Holmes. And they are looking at the whole UUP policy piece. I don't know how soon that they intend to actually meet and actually make headway on that. I will check in with her and Susan Murphy and ask for an update, and we'll provide it to you at future meetings as it becomes available. Again, I think our role there is one of due diligence and following up, as opposed to it's not particularly our process. Are there other questions here for Professor Pelletier or
Did you look at all when you make the statement that the right to spontaneous assembly must be preserved, what, for example, the city of Ithaca requires for protests or demonstrations? Was that taken into consideration, what local municipalities have as local law? Because I think some of the discussion is we should be treated as the free world and not the private university. But was that taken into account, any of those constraints or restrictions that local municipalities put on spontaneous demonstration or protest?
No. We were considering just campus.
And then I have one other question. Can employees engage in the same freedom of expression and peaceful protest and peaceful assembly with the same freedoms as disconnecting their agency of the university in those moments? Or is it only for faculty based on the unique nature of their positions at the university?
That's either way above or off to the side of my pay grade.
That's a good question.
I had the same thought. It's out of the purview of the faculty. Kathy Zoner, I don't know if you know the status of that.
I think that what you'll find is with staff, regular staff, non-academic staff, is that they are far more often viewed as agents of the university than faculty are. There are certain circumstances under which faculty are agents of the university, far more where they are able to express academic freedom, whereas regular staff are more, far more agents and far less an opportunity to express themselves against the university or against some other thing. I think the only point I would like to make on that is about employment and not about compliance with law. So that's about retaining a job and not about...
Or fear of retaining a job.
Yeah, or fear.
And I just want to say, because no matter what you do with these rules, the conflicts could still arise. And there could be that we could revisit this issue again and again, and that needs to be understood by everybody. So as soon as you rewrite the rules for getting a UUP, there's a chance someone will not be in compliance. And that'll represent a conflict for the agents of the university, whether it's faculty, staff, or the police, and they'll have to resolve it. So there's no way that I can imagine that you can rewrite this to avoid the conflict. I guess the issue will be, how do you actually adjust the code so the penalties feel appropriate given the mission of the university?
Well, without getting into solutions here, clearly there's no perfect solution. But one of the issues at stake is perhaps training.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are private property, but we don't feel like we're on private property mm-hmm. unless we're in a Cornell building. Outside, it feels very public, and yet it is not. And so that does have different legal standards. We're also a very special environment in that this is a learning place. We want students standing up and speaking out and learning and dealing with discourse, and that's a process to be protected and nurtured to as far as it can be without endangering, et cetera. There's where people would draw the line would probably be different places, but you kind of know where you stand.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of today's meeting really isn't to get into solutions. The problem is, as you knew before these presentations, large. And now we know what the Faculty Senate has handed over to us to work at. It doesn't limit us from working others' items, but we specifically do need to redress what they have referred to us and either put forth resolutions or put forth why we don't intend to put forth a resolution. This would also be consistent with the request that President Scorton made to us last academic year regarding these issues. So, do I need to lower the lines a little bit more? Can you know that halo doesn't give me kind
of we want the sun now, okay? We don't want it to go away.
Thank you, Professor Pelletier. Thank you very, very much. Was there one more question?
I just had a good question. It was kind of going off the fizz. Did the Texas Center look into at all what other universities do regarding their policies around protests or rallies?
We did not.
Okay. And to my knowledge, neither did the ad hoc committee.
Right. Thank you.
I will say we were told by a professor on the USC, I believe, that that Penn has a so-called free speech advocate who is appointed to, you know, specifically be present at events like that to, you know, to sort of monitor, etc. I don't know very much about the role of it, but that is all we. And this is all we heard about other universities, and it's a good question about, you know, what are best practices elsewhere. I don't know.
Can I ask you a thing? Would you mind sharing with the UA your PowerPoints that you both presented?
Well, Jim and I have talked about this. I would rather let the formal documents stand as the sole, you know, paper record or permanent record of our committee's report. And so on. I believe my PowerPoints don't have anything different than what is in the ad hoc committee report. I don't know about your report.
The same way, there's a bit more nuance in the written report, so it'll be more useful to you. And I don't know if you clarified with Joe Burns today whether that also is part of the.
All three of the documents that were sent to members are public documents. So the ad hoc committee report, that wasn't clear to me until definitively today. The ad hoc committee report that was sent to you by email, the minutes of the ad hoc committee's presentation to the faculty of the Senate, and the UFC's response are all public documents in the public record. So
the UFC report wasn't here.
But the actual, did the UFC publish an actual document?
Yes, there is a written document where we repeat the recommendation of the ad hoc committee and then we give our response.
We were not sent that. And do you have it, Greg?
No.
I don't have it either. Can we make that request to you, Professor Pelletier? I that also should be publicly available based on what Joe Burns has told me. But we have the discourse, but we don't that surrounded whatever it was. We don't have the report itself. And I think that would have added a little bit of clarity on from our end.
Okay. I'll just check through with Joe Burns again and I get that to you.
Thank you very much. Next item, totally changing the subject again today with the fact finding. We've already referred to the CJC, the matters that Professor Pelletier mentioned today, although I think there's a little more emphasis on the amplified sound piece than originally presented at our last meeting that we need to figure out how to resolve or who to work with to resolve. Next up, we have two resolutions, and gentlemen, you're welcome to stay and have more pizza or whatever. You can run and escape. Thank you again for your participation. David, you want to take us through resolution number one?
Sure.
This is an introduction. We don't intend to vote on anything tonight. This is to bring these things to you and walk you through the rationale for them and what we're thinking. We hope to vote on these next time, although if you'll see resolution two, we may have some additional changes.
I'm going to talk about my stuff. So I'm going to do four before three because there's a amount of order. Four actually has a bylaw change that affects number or item four on the agenda, resolution one, that you should have. Basically, both of these resolutions were passed last year, but there was no bylaw change to go with them. So President Scorton has seen the information in these, and now we just have to go authorize a physical change on the website. So in terms of resolution one in regards to the policy advisory group, which I believe we already have a liaison appointed, so this would just be adding an article to the bylaws to reflect basically a list of a list of roles that would be appointed by the chair of the committee. I don't know if reading through this, you guys
Do I need to bring this one up? Yeah, I'm just going to bring this one up. They go around the side, I don't think they wrap. Well, yes, they do. Go ahead, David.
Okay, so like I mentioned, we'd just be adding a sixth article to the bylaws that, with the section listing the liaisons we have right now, it will be kind of boring to have the policy advisor group under there. And then also, the removal process will be the same as any other standing committee. If there's no other questions, we'll move on to the next one.
If members have friendly amendments or other things to Resolution 1, we'll ask you to submit them to the vice chair within the next 2 weeks, and we'll bring Resolution 1 to a vote next week.
So this resolution, I know Chief Zoner has some extra information on this. Regarding the dissolution of the Public Safety Advisory Committee, and sort of adding into this President's Council on Campus Safety and Gender Sexual Violence, PCC, SGSB, a lot of letters are there. Again, this resolution was passed and approved by President Swarton last year. Although I should mention these changes aren't reflected on the internet or on Cornell's website. So currently, this Public Safety Advisory Committee, that should be a G. Or a C, is still like this online. So I'm not sure what the deal with that is. I emailed the main members of those committees and either didn't hear back or said they're no longer affiliated. So I'm not sure what transition process that is. But I guess you were saying you had some additional information.
Yeah, so essentially, as with all good things, in the summertime, everything changed a little bit. The intent remains the same, that there is a President's Council, which is now called President's Council on Sexual Violence Prevention. It's a little bit shorter, not so many letters. The Public Safety Advisor Committee, at the time of this writing, it was intended to replace that group, but because of those parameters that are set forth in Article 129A, Section 431, and because of the actual desire for the President's Council on Sexual Violence Prevention to have the right membership in it, those two are actually in direct conflict with each other. Article 129A states that you must have one-third students, one-third faculty, one-third staff, all of which must be selected in a certain way, 50% female. And the truth of the matter is, on the Council for Sexual Violence Prevention, it's over 30 people. It is imbalanced. There are a lot more staff on it because the staff are assigned to many of the things in the charge direct be done, both in 129A and the charge from the President to the Finance Council on Sexual Violence Prevention. That said, and the Public Safety Advisory Committee was intended to report directly to the President, so it is still an ad hoc, but they are still blended, if that makes sense. So the President's Council on Sexual Violence Prevention remains this at-large group of 30-plus members as right now, and they're still reviewing, trying to make sure we have everybody that we can, either at that table in particular, or in one of the working groups, in one of the working groups that council will then direct to address faculty curriculum, education and outreach, and research, and those types of things are the primary groups identified.
Kathy, may I interrupt with a point of order? We are out of time. Can I have a motion to extend the meeting 5 minutes so we can complete this discussion and also have you update us on CUPD training?
Second.
Anyone opposed? By unanimous consent, we've extended the meeting 5 minutes. Please continue.
Well, we're still seeking that Public Safety Advisory Committee be disassociated as a U.S. group. It becomes associated outside of a Robert's Rules of Order setting with the public, with the President's Council, and still does its reporting as directed by law directly to the President, still has that shared charge, but will take on its role. It'll take on its role within the President's Council, but will not be a subset thereof. It's a weird law thing that's been on the books since 1991 and hasn't grown with what the advancement of the order is, with directive specifically at the time. So there'll be a few corrections. I've given it to the strategic planning group that manages meetings sets for the President's Council. Also looks at documents and whatnot that support it. Also will help in getting the correct membership to the Public Safety Advisory Committee. They are looking at this resolution to make any friendly amendments and go back to you. They know that you want to get this signed off on. So it's mostly about the name change and of course the University Council will be involved too because of the whole legal aspect and making sure we don't change it too much and make it wrong. But the intent will remain the same. The intent will be to disassociate the Public Safety Advisory Committee from the UA.
So Kathy, who's going to help get
Tim Marshall and Ina Cummings right now because they were instrumental in drafting and having forwarded the presidential approval of the charge.
And so you forwarded this to them?
I did send this
to Kathy earlier. So.
Yep, they have this.
Okay, can I ask those people work with David to see if we can't perfect the verbiage?
When I wrote them, that's what I said. Get in touch with David, look at the verbiage, make sure we correct the name of the council so it's correct, and see if anything else. Actually, most of what I said probably doesn't have any problems with the set where ad is or the set intent down below. So there will be substantive changes that will.
And what we're, for the members, what we're seeking to do is, based on the resolution the President's Court accepted, remove the PSAG from our bylaws since we no longer have oversight jurisdiction for them, but to appoint a liaison to the appropriate committee because President Scorton in his response said he still wanted University Assembly input in what they send forward to him. So,
right, so that kind of fell to me by default because my email is asking people if they were meeting. They're like, oh, sure. Right, and so I introduced myself as the University Assembly member, making sure that they were meeting, and so they all considered me a point of contact.
And the group would be absolutely accepting if that needs to change for whatever reasons need to communication.
Well, on behalf of the UA exec, please continue in that capacity until we, A, pass our resolution, and then take up the process of formally appointing a liaison. So thank you for being an interim and showing your willingness. Probably you'll be punished by being elected. But
I don't know if it matters. I'm on the committee anyway, so I don't know if
that. Oh, wow, now there's a competition. We may have to have a secret ballot.
I don't know if you want to use that as a liaison.
Any more questions for David on Resolution 2 for now? We have a plan. Again, depending on if the changes are relatively easy in the next 2 weeks, we will try and bring this to a vote with those changes next meeting. If it gets to be too complex, we'll go again and push the meeting. Finally, I promised Kathy Zoner a few minutes to update us on what training CUPD actually gets with relation to events, et cetera.
We make this really easy. I have hard copies of a document that our boss asked us to put together outlining what our trainings are, so that's just available. Very briefly, you can feel free to take one. If anybody needs it electronically, I can send it electronically as well. We start already at the time that we advertise for somebody to come in to work for us. We're looking for a cultural match, not just to the police, but to the university itself. We have a selection committee. It's not easy being us, coming and joining us. The committee meets and reviews documents, submitted essay questions, telephone interviews, in-place board interviews, and we typically will get 200 applications for one position. So it's very competitive. We're not civil service. There's no tests that anybody takes. We don't, we're not beholden to any test-taking results as far as who scored the highest their floor. So that's actually in our benefit because we can do cultural match. We have diversity initiatives that are set forth to try to make sure that we are diversifying our forces. That's something we try to take into consideration as well.
Thank you.
With both recruiting and with our evaluation process. We work very closely with human resources and making the selections. And it's about a 5 to 6 month process before someone's selected to move forward. And we're looking strongly for cultural match. Skills can be taught to just about anybody. The cultural is either there or not. Basic training, we go through the same basic training as all municipal police officers, and that includes it's a requirement of over 650 hours. In actuality, most of our classroom enrollment is well over 1,000 hours of actual classroom and hands-on training. Proficiency areas that they focus on are administration of justice, so what you would think, law, constitutional law, discretionary powers, penal law, justification, use of force, criminal procedure law, civil liability, risk management, law enforcement procedures, investigations, interpersonal skills. Believe it or not, the police do actually on a municipal training council level teach interpersonal skills, communication skills, and as mentioned before, crowd control. Community relations, that goes into community policing as well as other relational aspects. Specifically focusing on vice-related incidents as well as sexual harassment and ethical awarenesses. And then, of course, the ever-present citizen fitness for people who are in our jobs. And I will share that almost every academy that we go to, typically our candidates are in the top 2% of the graduating class, and that those range in number from, I think the smallest one I observed was over with 9, but I was in a class of 30. Or they're the top one or two candidates in any one of a number of different categories they have. So we have people who really like to excel, both academically and in the physical aspects of the job. Then they're done with their academy, and then they come to Cornell for a 15-week field training, and that is where they're assigned directly in the site oversight of an officer who has special field training for being an evaluator. And there they learn the culture where they're working, as well as the geography and some of the local basics, writing tickets, arrest procedures. We go back at them with the criminal law, constitutional law, penal law, and the campus code of conduct. Very big in that aspect of training. In that training, they are they're observed and attached to an officer training. They're not allowed to separate from that officer, so you can't, if you're chasing a group of people, you're not allowed to split up and chase the group. They've got to stay together. I mean, that's how tightly they're supposed to stay together. They're still under observation. They are evaluated daily. There's an evaluation sheet that has bulleted points, and it starts every day. They're evaluated on their relationship with citizens in general, with ethnic and cultural social groups other than their own. They are evaluated on a 7-point scale. We expect all of them to start on the lower end of the scale because how could you possibly know what's expected of you here? So we can teach that to you, and we expect to see a growth phase throughout the training. If someone fails to achieve that growth, or fails to achieve an acceptable or towards the superior end of training, then we will remedialize them in whatever aspect that they need to be remedialized. If they fail to respond to that, then they're separated. And this is the cultural aspect of our university and our facilities, specifically around the issue of academic freedom and being an educational setting, are probably the number one reason why we separate the people in that space. They just don't get it. They'd rather go and not get somewhere.
Thank you. I would encourage members to pick up the handout on their way out, and if we have questions, we'll certainly follow up with you. I know it was a lot. I knew it was extensive. It's even more extensive than I imagined.
Read it. If you have any questions, you all have my email. Feel free to ask me if you need some clarification or want to see curriculum.
Our next meeting is November 12th. Topics and resolutions are due October 28th. Are there any objections to adjourning? Hearing none, we are adjourned. Yes.
So I think one of the things that's going to continue to hang up about the code is its relationship to the UUP in the return of the non-refer of what comes from what.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.